Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Tonight we focus on a particularly significant episode in the history of the Western world, or the history of the world indeed. And we talk with a very distinguished historian who's zeroed in on the trial of Adolf Eichmann, which began in Jerusalem on April 11th, 1961. Deborah Lipstadt, you were not there, I believe.
No, I wasn't.
Nor was I. You were a little girl. Where's your hometown?
I grew up in New York.
In New York proper.
Mm-hmm.
But you were aware of it as a little girl.
Yes, I remember seeing it on the newspaper, watching it on television, and I was quite aware of what was going on. It struck me as something really significant that a story about Jews was so prominently featured in the news.
Our audience is rather large, I'm pleased to say, and it varies over a wide range of ages. There are some listening to us who probably don't quite recognize the name. They may think they've heard it, but are not sure who or what it is. Some sort of Nazi, perhaps, but that's about all they know. Let us instantly define what the world knows and what elementary paragraph in an historical summary would say about Adolf Eichmann.
Adolf Eichmann was not the architect of the Final Solution, but he was one of the COOs, the chief operating officers. He was responsible for the deportation of probably 1.5 million Jews from Europe, from different parts of Europe. He didn't have his hand in all aspects of the Final Solution, but he certainly was one of the major figures.
He was there to send them to the killing grounds.
He was there to send them to the killing grounds, but he wasn't just a transportation officer. He was also someone who organized the trains, but he also made sure that the camps to which they were being sent were ready to accept them, could had enough room in the gas chambers to murder them. He tracked down Jews who escaped. He was all over this program.
And in Vienna, directly after the Anschluss, when the Germans take Austria in what year?
In 1938,
the year before the war. And then later in the capital of Hungary, in Budapest, during the war, he holds court for Jewish notables.
He does.
Struts before them, telling them they must instantly get all the Jews out of the country.
Exactly. First, in March 1938, he sent to Vienna to organize the deportation, or really the emigration of the Jews. This is before Jews are being deported to camps to be killed. And his job is to get them out of the Reich, to get them out of Austria. And he does it very well. He not only does it well, but he manages to strip the Jews of most of their belongings, any of their financial assets. When money comes in from Jewish organizations abroad to help the Jews, he exchanges at a rate that is highly favorable to the Third Reich. He does it, and he does it well from the Nazi perspective, and he does it without arousing the opposition of the Austrian non-Jewish population. So what he does in Austria, beginning in 1938, becomes a template for many of the deportations which will take place in other parts of Europe over the coming years.
And during the years of the war, he's very, very busy gathering all the Jews he can and shipping them off and placating his Nazi superiors, but also indeed cooperating with them and serving as an adjutant. One crucial role he plays is the sort of secretary at the Wannsee Conference.
Yes, he's the organizer of the Wannsee Conference. I mean, it's headed by Reinhard Heydrich, but he is the second in command. He takes care of all the technical details. He takes the minutes. And after the meeting, and let me point out, this meeting was held in a suburb of Berlin in the Wannsee House, and it was designed to do two things. A, to decide on how the killing of the Jews should proceed. It wasn't a meeting to decide on the killing, but how it should proceed. And B, to make sure that all the different ministries, justice ministry, labor, et cetera, were on board with this program.
And Heydrich actually is essentially reading the orders to all of these assembled heads of ministries, and also army and Nazi officials, is reading the orders about how we have to round up the Jews and kill them.
That's right.
The killing had already begun. The Wannsee Conference is in January of 42.
Correct. It's originally scheduled for December 41, but it's scheduled to happen on the same day as Pearl Harbor, so it's this delayed till January.
Now, what's very relevant, of course, and very crucial about Eichmann is that many of the leading Nazis were hunted down and captured or were and put on trial. Of course, the Nuremberg trials shortly after the war took the Nazi hierarchy and had all of them except Martin Bormann and Hitler, who, of course, had already committed suicide, and Goebbels, who had committed suicide, and Himmler, who had committed suicide.
Right.
I must say, incidentally, do you remember that Chaim Herzog was, in the years, in the months directly as the war ended, in British military intelligence up in Hamburg, and that he was one of the people who found and interrogated a guy disguised as a German private, namely Heinrich Himmler.
That's right. He used to talk about that. I didn't know that at the time. I wasn't alive. But I remember when he was president of the State of Israel, him talking about that.
And he talked with us about it on this very program once. It's an incredible picture, isn't it? The man who really presided over the murder of the Jews of Europe is discovered and interrogated by a man who will be the future president of Israel.
Precisely.
But back to the capture of Adolf Eichmann. He's, of course, living in Argentina, working, I think it's a Volkswagen factory, isn't it?
A Mercedes.
A Mercedes factory, rather, in Buenos Aires.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I think I've told you before, of the team, the Mossad team that grabbed him, the one guy who actually grabbed him physically, wrestled him to the ground, and pushed him into the car, I forget his name, you will remember it, was also on this program years ago.
Peter, I'm blocking on his last name for the moment, but it'll come to me in a minute.
He was also an artist.
That's right. He drew pictures of while Eichmann was in prison, or was in captivity, he drew pictures of him.
So they've got Eichmann. And they are going to ferret him out of Argentina illegally, so to speak. That is against the laws of Argentina. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of a kidnapping.
It's a kidnapping. But on one hand, I mean, obviously they're breaking the laws of Argentina. You can't just go into a country and take someone and put them on a plane and take them out. On the other hand, he was in Argentina illegally. He had arrived under a false name. He lived under a false name. So it was a bit of an ambiguous situation.
He was Roberto Clement.
Yes, that was the name he used, exactly.
There's a fascinating...
Peter Malkin, that's the name.
Malkin, exactly, is the man who wrestled him to the ground. There's a fascinating story about how that team located him and how they got him out of Argentina, but that's not what we're focused on tonight. Though you do give a brief and very effective account of all of that in the beginning of the new book, The Eichmann Trial. But before we go to The Eichmann Trial, I've got a few audio clips I want to play for you. And the first one, which we'll play just now, then we pause for some commercials, then we'll get to the trial, is the man who did it all, the man without whom it might very well never have happened. If you want to play historical counterfactuals, all you have to do is ask yourself, if Adolf Hitler had been killed as a soldier, as ein Frontsoldat, he was proud of having been a front soldier in World War I, would Nazism have risen and taken over Germany? Would the Holocaust ever have happened? I think the answer is no. Indeed, you remember somebody wrote an article titled in a commentary many years ago, Samuel Himmelfarb, titled No Hitler, No Holocaust.
Milton Himmelfarb. That's right.
Exactly. But before we go to some commercials and then back to the trial itself. Here is Hitler in German speaking before the Reichstag. The date is January 30th, 1939, still some months away from the beginning of World War II. Your German is surely better than mine, and I may ask you to translate this brief clip after we hear it.
Ich will heute wieder ein Prophet sein. Wenn es dem internationalen Finanzjudentum in und außerhalb Europas gelingen sollte, die Völker noch einmal in einen Weltkrieg zu stürzen, dann wird das Ergebnis nicht die Bolschewisierung der Erde und damit der Sieg des Judentums sein, sondern die Vernichtung der jüdischen Rasse in Europa.
He is predicting the Vernichtung des Judenrasse in Europa.
Right, he's saying that if the Jews should start a war or bring the world to a war, I'm paraphrasing, of course, it will not result in the extermination of the world or of Germany, but it will result in the extermination of the Jewish race.
And indeed, in his memoirs in early career in Mein Kampf, written, I think, in 1924-25,
correct,
he already signals that the ultimate solution to des Judenfrage, the Jewish problem, is to get all the Jews out of Europe, and he even suggests maybe you got to kill them.
Yeah, but I'm not sure he really means it at that time, or he imagines he'll be able to do it. That's unclear.
Yeah. Well, it's unclear even when the war begins whether
that's
that
right.
is
that's
his
right.
intention, but it, how it became his intention, how it became the mission of the German army as well as of the SS and all the other forces at Hitler's command, that is part of the story we will be telling as we return. First, now we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Deborah Lipstadt, who is the author of the very important and utterly compelling new book, The Eichmann Trial. Deborah Lipstadt is professor of modern Jewish history and Holocaust studies at Emory University in Atlanta. And she's talking to us from Atlanta on an ISDN line, so it sounds as if she's here in the studio, and I wish you were in the studio.
I do, too.
But as you have been in the past. But let's come directly to the trial. We're leaving out a great deal, including how they were clued in to find Eichmann in the first place and all the details of getting him out and the claims by some people that they were responsible for it all, but in fact were not, particularly Simon Wiesenthal,
right,
who got in on the act when he should not have done.
Yeah, well, Wiesenthal had a major role in keeping the issue of Nazi war criminals
in
the public eye, but he really was not responsible for the capture of Eichmann, though he was credited with it for many years thereafter.
Yeah, he made that claim in many venues, even, again, on this program many, many years ago when he wrote a memoir and appeared here. But a crucial figure in the pursuit of Eichmann and then in the decision to hold the trial and to stage it as an event for all the world to see was, of course, David Ben-Gurion.
Right. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of the State of Israel, could have told the Israeli operatives, the security forces who were sent to find Eichmann when Israel was told, and wasn't told once, but was told over and over again, in fact, by a German prosecutor where Eichmann was. He could have told them, just go down there and get rid of the guy, and Eichmann could have disappeared, and that would have been the end of the story. But somehow Ben-Gurion understood the importance of bringing him back and putting him on trial. And there doesn't seem to have been any hesitancy, and nothing I found indicates any hesitancy in Ben-Gurion's mind about doing this, that right away he said, find him, bring him back, and we're going to put him on trial.
And that trial begins almost 50 years ago to the day. The anniversary is approaching. April 11th, 1961 was the beginning of the trial. But before the trial began, a fellow named Avner Less, who was, I guess, a Mossad agent as well, or a Mossad...
Actually, Avner Less was a policeman. He was really a policeman.
He was straight police, yeah.
Police, he was straight police, and he was part of what was called Bureau 06, which was assigned to prepare the indictment of Eichmann.
And he spends a lot of time talking to Eichmann.
Tremendous amount of time.
And he has published an account of his interrogations of Eichmann. What sort of Eichmann begins to emerge from his response to Less and to others as he's held in In custody before the trial began.
You know, if you read the in the interrogation and then you read what Less writes about it afterwards, clearly the Eichmann who emerges is not the gray, sort of dull-looking bureaucrat who sits in the glass booth during much of the trial. But here's a man who will is somewhat placid, somewhat easygoing, but as soon as he realizes that Less may have a document or may have something that's going to entrap him or point the finger of blame at him, he begins to fight and to fight back fiercely. And the stronger he fights, Less says, the more Less realizes that he's lying.
His basic defense in those interrogations and throughout the trial is he plays variations on this same basic number. And that number is, I had nothing particularly against the Jews. I helped the Jews.
I helped some Jews escape. I had a friend
exactly.
who was a Jew. So, you know,
but I was following orders.
Right. I was following orders, and I didn't play a role in the actual killing. I was just, there were people higher than I who had a more direct role. I was simply a desk bureaucrat carrying out what I was assigned to do.
Isn't that the template for the basic excuse given by Nazi exterminators in the millions?
That's right.
After the war.
Maybe not in the millions, but certainly in the tens
of
thousands.
In the tens of thousands, to be
yes.
sure.
Yes. I was just following orders. I was assigned to do this. I had no choice. The irony, and I know it's ironic, but the truth of the matter is that in all the years of war crime trials dealing with the Third Reich, never has a defense attorney of any war crime defendant been able to demonstrate that if you didn't do this, you would be killed. You know, people often say, as Eichmann did, if I hadn't done this, I would have been killed. And that's just not, we just have no proof of that.
Yeah.
And if there was proof of it, I can assure you that some defense attorney would have found it and would have cited it in the case.
Set the stage for us, the trial, the actual location of the trial, the personnel, et cetera.
Okay, well, it's, you know, at this point, it's 1961, and Jerusalem's really a backwater. It's the end of every bus line, the end of the train line. You get there, you're surrounded on three sides by Jordan, and it's a small, dusty town. And of course, it's the capital of Israel, and that's where the trial will be. And Ben-Gurion has an assistant, a man named Teddy Kollek, who goes is going to go on to be mayor of Jerusalem for many, many years and shape Jerusalem and shape the when Jerusalem is unified after the 67 war.
No, I can't resist the temptation. Whatever comes up of mentioning the people who've been on this program.
I'm sure he's been on your program.
Kollek was on the program
twice, as I remember.
He was
a fascinating character.
Wonderful man.
Any case, Kollek is assigned the job to find the place to hold the trial. And there is a building, a cultural center, being built quite close to what was then the Knesset building in the center of Jerusalem called Beit Ha'am, the House of the People. It was supposed to be a cultural center with a theater and meeting rooms, etc. And Kollek says this would be the perfect place because the courtrooms are tiny and old and can't handle the crowd, wouldn't be able to handle the press, totally inadequate. And I think one of the most amazing things is Beit Ha'am is then under construction. And Kollek says, look, I need it constructed by, you know, spring of in a year, in a little less than a year. And it's actually finished on time, which is quite amazing given the rate of construction in the Middle East and particularly in Israel. But in any case, they use the theater and they transform this theater into a courtroom. They build walls, and behind the walls, they set up areas for cameras. They decide to film the entire trial so it can be televised and can be shown abroad. Israel doesn't have television then, so it can't be shown on Israeli television. So that's one aspect of the trial, the venue. But also there's the problem of who's going to defend Eichmann. And Israel is committed to making this as fair a trial as possible, because one of the criticisms that has been made is, how can Israel hold a trial? How can the Jews fairly try a man who was accused of having been involved in their annihilation? It's interesting, Hannah Arendt, who is going to be very critical of many aspects of the trial, I'm sure we'll get to talk about her quite a bit, but she actually discounts that objection because she points out that there were post-war, post World War II trials in Poland and trials in the then Czechoslovakia, and no one asked how could the Poles or the Czechs be fair and be just. But when it came to the Jews, there was that question.
Of course, another argument, which they were aware of, was how can you try somebody in a country that did not exist?
That's right.
When these crimes were committed.
That's right. Not only in a country which did not exist, but under a law that's only passed in 1950
exactly.
By the Knesset, and the killing of people who aren't citizens of that country. Now, what Ben-Gurion says about that last point is that these people would have come to Israel if they hadn't been killed, which is actually not true. Many of them would not have come to Israel, but some of them would have. But in terms of the ex post facto nature of the law, the truth of the matter is that aspects of the Nuremberg tribunals were also ex post
facto.
The very same. Because the laws, crimes against humanity was not a concept that existed early. What the Israeli judges, when Eichmann's a lawyer, and I'll talk about how he's chosen in a moment, but when the Israeli judges, Eichmann's lawyer challenges this, one of the points they made is that you don't need a law to make it clear that killing and being involved in the killing of millions of
people. There is a higher law above the mere laws of variable nations.
That's right.
We are about to pause a regularly scheduled newscast from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight, and a very distinguished one indeed, Deborah E. Lipstadt, author of the new book, The Eichmann Trial. Deborah Lipstadt is professor of modern Jewish history and Holocaust studies at Emory University in Atlanta. And I note that this is the very day of the official publication of this book.
It is. You're the first interview I'm doing post-publication. It was published today, and today was when all my friends, I won't say which company, but who ordered it on their electronic readers, suddenly woke up this morning and found it there.
Well, I'm delighted that we have first dibs, so to speak. Let's go directly back to the court in Jerusalem. We're getting the cast of characters lined up. They're after a defense attorney from...
Yes.
And the question is, how do you get one?
How do you get one, and who should defend him?
Yeah.
Israel,
it can't be a former Nazi.
No. That Israel says it cannot be a former Nazi. It cannot be someone who's a member of the Nazi Party. That just would be unacceptable. On the other hand, they really want someone, a serious defense attorney, because they want this to be considered a fair trial. A number of Israeli lawyers step forward and say, we're willing, in the name of a just trial, we're willing to defend him. But the government, the attorney general, feels that this would be dangerous. Remember that this trial is coming a number of years, about 5 years after the Kastner trial. Rudolf Kastner, Israel Kastner, was a Hungarian Jew who actually had negotiated with Eichmann. And after the war came to Israel, he managed to stay out of jail. He managed to not be deported. He saved about 1,500 Jews on a train that was able to leave Hungary. Though after the war, there were Hungarian Jews who accused him of not having warned them about what happened, of not having alerted them. And I think it's a much more complicated.
And they accused him as well of saving rich Jews.
Saving rich Jews
and his own family.
Yeah. Exactly. Much of which is not true, as we now know. But in any case, Kastner was accused of this by a Hungarian Jew in Israel, a man named Michael Grunwald, and Grunwald sent out letters accusing him of this, and Kastner was, who worked as a small bureaucrat in the government office, was told that he had to either resign or sue for libel because the government couldn't allow him to continue and not act on these accusations. Well, he sued Grunwald for libel. And the judge in the case, Judge Halevi, eventually found for Grunwald, found that Grunwald had not libeled Kastner. And it's a complicated story. Kastner was actually far more innocent than he was made to appear.
But then somebody shot him down.
Right. And what happened, Kastner appealed, and eventually the Israeli High Court, equivalent of our Supreme Court, overturned the ruling. But before they could do that, before that was handed down, he was assassinated on the streets outside of his home in Tel Aviv. So there was a fear that if a lawyer defended Eichmann, some nut, some passionate person, somebody who had lost family in in the Holocaust, somebody would take a gun and shoot this.
So finally they locate a guy named
Servatius. In fact, the Eichmann family wants Servatius to represent Eichmann. He's not a member of, he hadn't been a member of the Nazi party, but he had served at, he had served at Nuremberg defending certain Nazis at Nuremberg. So they, Servatius is engaged, but then who's going to pay him? The Eichmann family says we can't afford to pay him. Now, generally, the German government, if a German was being charged in a war crime outside the boundaries of Germany, Germany would pay for that person's defense, feeling that that was its obligation to defend people who were Germans who were accused. In this case, Germany refused to pay. They said Eichmann had snuck away from Germany, had left under assumed name, had lived under an assumed name, and therefore had nullified his right to ask for support from Germany. My sense is that Germany just wanted to have nothing to do with this case. It wanted to keep arm's length. And in fact, we sort of skipped over this, but when people, when some of the critics of Israel holding the trial were asked, well, where should the trial be? They said it should be in Germany. That was the last thing Konrad Adenauer wanted for Germany. He, the Chancellor Adenauer, did not want this trial to be held in Germany. And for him, it was a matter of enough of the Nazi period. Let's move forward.
So Israel undertakes the obligation to pay him.
I think about $30,000, which now, it still is a considerable sum, but then was even more considerable.
Now Gideon Hausner gets the assignment as the prosecutor.
Right.
Who was he at the time?
Gideon Hausner was a commercial lawyer who had no trial experience. He had become attorney general shortly before this period. In fact, he had been a compromise choice for attorney general because of certain political developments, and the other candidates didn't take the job, so he was given the job. And many people were hoping that he would appoint an experienced prosecutor to handle this trial, but he took it for himself.
And he didn't do a bad job at all.
He didn't do a bad job. Well, he made some crucial mistakes, and the judges, in fact, this is the interesting thing, and people call it a show trial. It's really not a show trial because the sense was, for a number of reasons, but one of the things, if there was fighting in the courtroom between the judges and other participants in the trial, it was not between the judges and Servatius, but it was between the judges and Hausner.
Well, particularly over Hausner's decision, which he then acted upon, to bring in lots of people who had no direct evidence about Eichmann at all, some of whom probably during the years of the Shoah, had never heard
Eichmann, the name Eichmann.
But they had horrible stories to tell about
That's
the extermination
right.
of their families.
Right. Well, the judges and Hausner had two different conceptions of what the trial should be. The judges had a very formalistic conception, very close to what some of the critics of the trial, again, I mentioned the name Hannah Arendt, who has a very strong Chicago connection.
Deborah, I must tell you that when I first arrived as a sort of a junior professor at the University of Chicago, they put me on a few committees, and on one of them, one of the committee members was Hannah Arendt.
I'm sure that was quite an experience.
It was rather intimidating.
Yes, I'm sure. But in any case, the judges had this formalistic and traditional conception of a trial that the only thing that should be brought before the court is what those instances and those facts to which Eichmann can be directly linked. Hausner had a different conception. Hausner had a conception that this was a man, and at that point, his perception, many people's perception, was that Eichmann was really the chief architect of the final solution, which, as I said earlier, he wasn't. He was an important character. He was a COO, but he wasn't the chief architect. But since Hausner felt that Eichmann had been involved in all aspects of the Shoah, he could legitimately tell the story of the Shoah from beginning to end, even if you couldn't directly connect Eichmann to it.
And all of that rather recorded with Ben-Gurion's intention for the trial as well, didn't it?
That's right. Well, Ben-Gurion's intention, it isn't immediate, but over the course of time, once Eichmann is brought to Israel, Ben-Gurion's perception of what this trial should be evolves to seeing it as an educational enterprise. This is something that should educate the new generation of Israelis, those born after the Holocaust, both about what the Holocaust was all about and, even more importantly, why, therefore, a state of Israel is so crucial to the Jewish people.
And also to educate the world.
That's right. That's true.
I have another sound clip. This is the very moment for it. Here is Hausner speaking in Hebrew, of course, but with a translation in English over his voice, in a portion of his opening statement, the very portion that I think you quote
in
your book.
When I stand before you, judges of Israel, in this court to accuse Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. Here with me at this moment stand 6 million prosecutors. But alas, they cannot rise to level the finger of accusation in the direction of the glass dock and cry out j'accuse against the man who sits there, because their ashes have been piled up in the mounds of Auschwitz and the fields of Treblinka, or spilled into the rivers of Poland, and their graves are scattered throughout the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries to heaven, but their voice cannot be heard. Thus it falls to me to be their mouthpiece and to deliver the heinous accusation in their name.
It's an eloquent paragraph. Yeah. It really is. First of all, if you know the Hebrew, he uses a number of biblical references: Shoftei Israel, judges of Israel, Nitzavim Kan, we stand before you. It's a direct quote from the Bible. Damam Tzoek, their blood cries out. It's the blood of the story of Cain and Abel. The same words are used there. It had a resonance for Israelis listening and for people who listened to it in translation, because many of the reporters spoke about how struck they were by that opening paragraph. And then, of course, Zola to j'accuse.
The j'accuse, of course, is also a quotation from Emile Zola with regard to the Dreyfus case.
Right.
Which goes way back to the 1880s or 1890s?
Early 1900s.
Early 1900s, yes. We are about to pause for the usual reason, a round of commercials. When we return, let's go to the trial itself and what was disclosed and how people handled themselves in the face of this great revelation, or this great purgation, one might call it, in which the whole horror of the Holocaust was put before the world, for the world to come to terms with, if indeed they did. Though, of course, as you well know, because you've been much involved in this, Holocaust denial became, maybe even in response to that trial, or I suppose it must have started before that trial, became a kind of a cottage industry practiced in various sectors of the world, including in this country. And certainly one of its major advocates was somebody with whom you had a significant courtroom encounter later on.
To say the least,
David Irving in England. Right now, though, some brief entrepreneurial messages, and then directly back to Deborah Lipstadt.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are tonight noting the publication, officially on this very day, of the book The Eichmann Trial by Deborah Lipstadt. And Deborah Lipstadt, professor of Jewish history. What's the official title I had?
Modern Jewish and Holocaust Studies.
There we go. At Emory University is my guest. And a word about the making of this book before we get back to the trial. In fact, how do you do a trial that happened 50 years ago?
Well, you start out by, first of all, reading a lot about Eichmann, and there have been some very good studies of Eichmann himself published in recent years. And then you sit down and read the interview, or the interrogation, rather, and then you read the transcript. You just plow your way through the transcript, and I was very lucky. The Ministry of Justice of Israel has translated the transcript into English, so I was able to read it in English. If I had a question, I could go to the Hebrew, but it was just easier, faster to do it in English, but I used both the English and the Hebrew.
You also had the video record. There's a vast amount of that material available.
That was one of the things I mentioned earlier. This was the first... This was the first sort of international televised event in that sense, in that there was the trial was filmed. Israel had been approached by the three major networks, to ABC, CBS, and NBC, and instead it chose a little company that was not at all known, and everybody was amazed. It chose this company called Capital Cities, which of course now owns ABC, and eventually went on to own ABC. And they filmed the trial. They would film the trial, and each night the film would be flown to the States and then shown on American television the following night.
There are two basic interpretations. Indeed, one might say there are two basic books about the trial. One was written by a woman you've mentioned a number of times, Hannah Arendt, and the other is yours. And the views that the two of you take are clearly opposite, mm-hmm. and almost at polar extremity. Shall we talk first about Hannah Arendt and what she reported to the world?
Okay, Hannah Arendt was then a professor at Princeton. She was the first woman to be made a full professor at Princeton. She had come from Germany. She had been a student in Germany, and she had escaped when the Nazis came to power because she was part of the a Zionist organization, and she was afraid that they would arrest her. She spent the mid-30s in Paris. And then when the Germans came to Paris, she escaped from Paris and came to this country. In early 1950s, I think it's 51, 52, she publishes The Origins of Totalitarianism, which establishes her reputation. By the way, during the 40s, she worked for a while for the press, one of the press that published my book, Shock and Press. And she was an editor there, and as well did other things. And then
and she gets a reputation as a major political philosopher.
Yes.
A reputation which persists to this day, surely.
To this day. And then when the trial is announced, she says, and she writes in one of her letters, that she had missed the, or actually it's, she writes a, she has been offered a semester at Rockefeller University, and she postpones it. And she, in explaining why she wants to postpone it, she says, "I missed the Nuremberg trials. And I owe it to myself." She makes a statement where she owes it. It's both an intellectual enterprise to test out her theory of, and to see her theory of, origins of totalitarianism in the flesh, and seeing this perpetrator in the flesh on the stand. But also she owes it, she says, "I owe it to my past." So it's a personal enterprise as well as an intellectual enterprise. She comes to Jerusalem. And before she comes to Jerusalem, she arranges that she will cover the trial for The New Yorker. The New Yorker had just published a series of articles by James Baldwin on the African-American community. Mm-hmm. And it seems, we sort of assume, that this was their way of sort of dealing with the Jewish community. So she's going to write these series of articles for The New Yorker, which will eventually be published as Eichmann in Jerusalem, The Banality of Evil.
Yes, and The Banality of Evil, the subtitle of her book, makes one of the two basic points. The point is that Eichmann was not a great murderer, not a great evil sociopathic or psychopathic monster. He was simply an ordinary man, a rather stupid man probably, and caught up in bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. That the ultimate issue of modern authoritarianism and modern totalitarianism is to so regulate and so organize and overorganize that you can do the worst horrors, but do them in a sort of a routinized way and get ordinary people to execute the monstrous act.
Exactly. Now, there's some things I should say that Hannah Arendt got very right. And in fact, she got them so right that today they're the normative way of how we understand the Holocaust. For instance, she recognized that perpetrators of genocide need not be, and generally are not, people who look different, sound different, act in a manner that's different than the way you or I would act. But they are seemingly normal people who'd go on to do horribly abnormal things. And her question was why. And she says
her basic answer was to build a career,
and because the society in which they live creates it as the norm, so it, you know, they don't think it's wrong. And I think what she missed on Eichmann, in fact, there are even scholars, someone like Christopher Browning
yes.
at University of North Carolina, who's written many important books, including The Origins of the Final Solution, and Ordinary Men is probably his most famous book.
Yes, indeed.
And he very much subscribes to Hannah Arendt's thesis, but he says about Eichmann, she got Eichmann wrong. She was fooled by Eichmann. Yeah. She saw Eichmann as this sort of listless bureaucrat sitting in that box. She, of course, wasn't there when Hausner cross-examined him.
She just popped in and out of the trial.
She was there, and then she left, and she came back, but she wasn't there for those crucial days where people really felt with the turning point.
The other big assertion she makes in that book, which aroused even more anger in the world, certainly in the Jewish world, was that those who were exterminated were in a way complicit in their own extermination. And particularly she blames the Judenrat, that is the Jewish councils set up by the Nazis.
That's exactly
Who cooperated with the Nazis in providing people to fill the quotas for extermination.
That's right. She says at one point, and again I paraphrase, but that the Jews in the ghettos faced two enemies, the Nazis and the Jewish councils.
Yeah.
The Jewish councils were appointed by the Nazis and then, you know, and they go through many different incarnations. The first members of the councils generally are leaders from before the war, and then they can be sent away if they aren't listening, and others can be put in their place, et cetera, et cetera. And there are hundreds of councils all over Europe. But their job in many of the ghettos is to make the list of who will be deported, as opposed to the Germans just coming in and scooping up whomever they see on the street.
To fill the quotas week by week, ultimately day by day.
Exactly. And her belief is that they never really had the right to do this. No one gave them the right to decide who shall live and who shall die.
And also her point is that even in the camps, the Jews vastly outnumbered their captors and killers, and they should have acted up and revolted.
Well, there's a certain contempt that I find in some of the comments she makes about the Jews. And other times she sort of tempers it. She says, you know, they didn't fight back, but then again, no one else did. But the way she says it, that phrase, that qualifying phrase, no one else did, gets lost. There is a certain contempt she has for the victims. But at the other hand, and I think this gets lost, there's certain things she says which are very powerful. First of all, she points out, and when I read this, I had read the book, of course, many years ago, but I read it much more closely and carefully this time in preparation for writing the book. She says that one of the significance of this trial, that this was the first time since the Second Temple, or since the time of Jesus, since 70 CE or AD, that Jews would have the ability to sit in judgment of someone who had done them wrong. There had been Jewish courts in the years since where Jews sat in judgment of other Jews, but this was the first time since that time that Jews would be able to sit in judgment of someone who had done them wrong. And that's a breathtaking observation. Mm-hmm. It's not profound, but it's still I found it a breathtaking observation. There are other things she notices. There was one of the people who gave testimony was a man named Abba Kovner. Abba Kovner had led the at age 19. He had been one of the first people in all of Europe to call for an uprising, not the first Jews, but first people, to call for an uprising, armed uprising against the Nazis. The Vilna uprising fails. He escapes to the forest. He joins up a resistance group. After the war, he comes to Israel. At first, he helps Jews escape from Europe to get to Palestine. Then after the establishment of the state, he settles on a kibbutz, and he becomes one of Israel's leading poets. So from the Israeli perspective, he's a fighter. He's a man who works with his hands on the soil, and he's a poet. He's, you know, all the attributions you need, alamilis, as they would say in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
Kovner gets on the stand and doesn't testify. He gives a speech. He gives a speech that he's been giving all around Israel about the Holocaust, about the fight, etc. And Arendt hates his testimony. The judges do too, because they feel it has nothing to do with the trial and is really a showpiece for him. But there's one moment in his testimony which Arendt captures. And he tells the story of a German sergeant, a man named Anton Schmidt, who, in his capacity as a sergeant, helped Jews in the resistance, got money to them, got uniforms, got arms to them. And he did this for a number of months until he was caught and killed. And Arendt writes that when Kovner told the story of Anton Schmidt, a hush settled over the courtroom. And she says it was as if the people in the courtroom had decided to give Anton Schmidt the 3 minutes of silence he so richly deserved. And you couldn't help but think how different things would be in this courtroom, in this country, in the world, if there had been more people like Anton Schmidt.
We must pause right now. We're a bit overdue for an update on the news. Then directly back to Deborah Lipstadt and the Lipstadtian view of what the trial actually revealed. But first, to the WGN newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Deborah Lipstadt. We're drawing from her very interesting, very important new book, The Eichmann Trial. So, as I say, the Lipstadtian view. And, of course, you can base that not only on what transpired in the trial, but on the Sasson documents. You can explain what those are. Mm-hmm. And the memoir that he wrote even while he was in prison in Israel, and on Avner Less's memoirs and so on. What's your overall image, your overall theory of the nature of the man?
The nature, I think this man became, he may not have started out as an inveterate anti-Semite, but he became an absolutely committed anti-Semite. Anti-Semitism was something that burned within his soul.
Enjoying and favoring the murder of Jews
of
as well.
Of the Jews. Not only, you see what struck me and most when I read the documents and read the transcript of the trial was not solely how he organized the deportations of tens of thousands of ultimately, as I say, approximately 1.5 million Jews, but how he would track down every single Jew. If, for instance, Italy at one point complained to the German Foreign Office that a Jew who was married to an Italian Catholic woman, and in fact the father-in-law was a member of the Italian Fascist Party, had been caught up and was imprisoned in a ghetto, I think in the Ludge ghetto, and how they wanted to find out about him. Eichmann hastened to have him deported so that the Italians couldn't put their hands on him. This happened over and over again. If it looked like someone might be able to get out, if it looked like someone might be able to escape deportation, Eichmann tried to preempt that by deporting him, by going after him.
Deporting him and having him killed.
Yes, yes. Deporting him knowing that the person would be killed. And so he was absolutely committed to this effort, number one. Number two, he said a number of times, both in Germany right at the end of the war and then again in Argentina when this assassin, Dutch Nazi, convinced him to record his memoirs and convinced him that they would be able to put them together as a book and sell them and show the right side of and the correct side of what Germany had done. He again reiterates how happy, how satisfied he is with the fact that he was able to be involved in the killing, in the murder of all these Jews. So this is not a man who shows any repentance. This is not a man who is a reluctant killer. This is a man, he starts out before the war, he's a traveling salesman. He sells, I mean, he does very well at the job he's doing, but he's essentially selling people on building gas stations and fuel, etc.
And working for some Jews as well.
That's right, that's right. The company for which he works is run by Jews. They hire him as a favor to an aunt of his, an aunt by marriage. And, you know, so this is a man who absolutely is committed to doing this. I think she gets him wrong. She gets many things right, as I said earlier. Mm-hmm. And she says many important things, which I found very powerful. But I think in the nature of the man, she gets him completely wrong.
One thing that strikes me as a psychologist looking on at fourth hand, so to speak, and which I learned from your book, is that there's a very infantile and really a very insecure kind of posturing when he stands before Jewish notables and brags to them that he is their best friend and that he knows both Hebrew and Yiddish and is a deep scholar in Judaism.
Right. When he says this to a group of Viennese Jews,
yeah,
that he knows Hebrew, and he says Shema Yisrael. And when they're asked, did he really know Hebrew, the Jewish leader said, I don't know. I didn't know Hebrew, so I couldn't tell if he knew Hebrew. But he didn't know Hebrew.
No,
he didn't know Hebrew. He started the story that he'd been born in Palestine. He wasn't. That was all. He was born.
It's total confabulation.
Born in
actually.
Germany, raised in Austria. Yeah. But yes, when they come to see him, he says, step back, step back. He makes them stand behind a barrier. He sweeps down the hall, knocking women and children out of his way. In fact, one of the representatives of the Ministry of Justice who's with him, of the German Ministry of Justice, who's in charge charge of the Jewish desk there, found himself frightened by Eichmann. And he was a peer of Eichmann's, but watching him operate. And he said when they walked into the room, the Jewish leaders who had been waiting for him for a number of hours jumped up and like parrots sort of repeated the information they were to give him. He was absolutely reveling in his power over the Jews and then reveling in his ability to kill them.
Deborah, I've got another sound clip. Here is Eichmann. Now we will hear the voice of Eichmann and two of the judges who are interrogating him. And at one point, are getting rather annoyed at him, to say the least. Again, you might be able to do some service in translation after we hear this clip. It runs around a minute and a half. Here it is.
Ohne Sie zum Schreiben, könnte mich dessen auch ganz bestimmt nicht mehr erinnern, wenn ich nicht wüsste, dass ich mir damals gesagt hätte, schau, der Stuckart, den man immer als einen sehr genauen und sehr heiklen Gesetzesonkel betrachtete. Und da hier war eben das, der Ton und die ganzen Formulierungen waren hier sehr unparagraphenmäßig gewesen.
Was hat er über dieses Thema gesagt?
Im Einzelnen, Herr Präsident, möchte ich
nicht sagen. Nicht im Einzelnen, Law,
Es wurde von Töten und Eliminieren und Vernichten gesprochen. Ich selber hatte ja meine Vorbereitungen zu machen für die Protokollangelegenheit. Ich konnte nicht dastehen und einfach zuhorchen. Aber die Worte drangen eben zu mir heran, denn das Zimmer war ja nicht so groß gewesen, als dass man in den Wortschwall nicht einzelne Wörter hätte aufgeschnappt.
Und was über dieses wichtige Thema gesprochen wurde, davon erinnern Sie sich überhaupt nicht.
So sagen, Herr Präsident, das ist nicht das Wichtigste, ist sowieso hineingekommen ins Protokoll.
Das soll also heißen, dass die Tötungsarten ein unwichtiges Thema waren.
Ah, die Tötungsarten?
Also sehr nachkommen, dass Ihnen darüber sprechen wir. Wurde damals über Tötung durch Gas gesprochen?
Nein, mit Gas nicht.
We hear the ruffle of amazement and horror in the audience.
This is towards the end of the trial. They're talking about the Wannsee conference and the protocol and what he had included in it and whether the method of killing was going to be included in it. And he said no. And the judges assumed that it hadn't been, I think it's Landau who's questioning there, that it hadn't been included because the Nazis sort of wanted to keep that hidden. He said, no, it just wasn't felt to be important. It's really quite a very powerful moment.
Yeah, horrifying, truly horrifying. We are about to pause for the usual reasons. And when we come back, I should say to our audience first, we'll go to the phones after the 10:30 news break. And we are opening the lines right now. The number, of course, is, as ever, 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. But when we come back after some impending commercials, I think we have to ask, what do we learn from this? What do we derive from it 50 years after the fact of the trial, which has continuing meaning for us? But of course, we should at least briefly talk about the verdict that was rendered and the death of Adolf Eichmann, and then on to the meaning 50 years later of this tragic chapter in the history of the Western world. We return directly to Deborah Lipstadt after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we come to what I think is the payoff question in our conversation, Deborah. What meaning do you take from it? Well, I might put the question this way. What did you learn when you get deep into the materials that surprised you?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if it surprised me so much. I think I learned a number of things.
Yeah.
First of all, and we really didn't focus on this that much, but Hausner made a decision, Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor, made a decision, as we mentioned earlier, to call all these witnesses who would tell the story of the Holocaust. He has close to 100, I think, survivors who testify. And when the judges made their decision, they didn't rely on that testimony. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, they were annoyed by a lot of that testimony because it didn't directly relate to Eichmann. They said, we based ourselves on the documents. This testimony will be of interest to the historians. Well, the truth of the matter is that that may have been the most crucial aspect of this trial, that for the first time, people were hearing from survivors, not one or two at a time, but this long series of survivors. I'm not suggesting survivors hadn't spoken about what happened to them before. They had. They had given testimony and they had written books, and there was a lot going on, much more than some of us imagine, but now as we know, people were speaking.
And they were heard in the successor Nuremberg trials after the first major one.
Yeah, but nowhere near as much as this. This was the first time that survivors of the Holocaust were given such a hearing and people listened. So that the voice of the victim of genocide, the voice of the victim of the Holocaust had a clarity that it hadn't had before and was heard in a clarified fashion the way it hadn't heard before. So I think that's one of the things. The other thing that struck me, and I don't know if it surprised me or it was something that I didn't know before, but this trial brought home in such a clear fashion, and it almost sounds silly to say it when you're talking about the Holocaust, but sometimes it needs repeating, the endemic nature of anti-Semitism, the hatred, this is the oldest hatred in the world. And it reminded me that when someone says that they have evil intentions, especially when it comes to anti-Semitism, one could say it about racism as well and some other isms, but certainly about anti-Semitism, believe them. Take them at face value. It doesn't mean you have to panic on every time someone says something anti-Semitic. We've had examples this past couple of weeks of, you know, minor characters making anti-Semitic remarks. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about someone like an Ahmadinejad. I'm talking about when you know, in these wonderful uprisings that we've had in the Middle East, some of which seem to be fizzling, but nonetheless, when some of the reporters were being attacked by we don't know exactly whom, and this cries of Jew, Jew, Jew. When you hear this kind of anti-Semitism, but especially when you hear it from a head of state who potentially has nuclear weapons at his fingertips, take it seriously.
Absolutely. And when you hear it even in this country from organizations who are committed to anti-Semitism.
That's right.
There's a psychologist, I'm blocking on his name, who's got an appointment as a professor of psychology, just as I do, at a Western university, who also is sort of interested.
Oh, you're talking about Kevin O'Donnell.
Exactly.
McDonald.
Kevin McDonald.
He was a witness for David Irving. He testified on behalf of David Irving at my trial.
We haven't made clear what that brouhaha was about. You want to say something about it?
Sure. My earlier work was concerned Holocaust denial, and in a book I wrote that was published in the early 90s on Holocaust denial, I mentioned David Irving, who identified him as the world's leading Holocaust denier. He's a Brit. He writes about history. He's not a historian. His books are so full of lies and distortions that you can't call him a historian. And he sued me for libel in the United Kingdom for calling him a Holocaust denier.
Because they had republished your book in England.
They had republished my book in England. And in England, the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove the truth of what they said, as opposed to in America,
no,
where it's on the accuser to prove the falsehood. So if I hadn't fought back, he would have won by default. And I think he assumed I wouldn't fight back, that I'd just ignore it, et cetera, et cetera. But I did fight back, and I had a wonderful legal team, and we called historians as expert witnesses. And it wasn't to prove that the Holocaust happened, but it was to prove that what deniers say happened is all a lie. We traced his footnotes back to his documents and showed that the documents said A, and he said they said X. The document said B, and he said it said Y. Complete turning, it was a tissue of lies. So that was what that trial was all about. And one of the people who testified for David Irving was this Kevin McDonald, who is a professor at Long Beach State University.
That's the one, yeah.
Right. And he's a unapologetic anti-Semite and Holocaust denier.
Strangely, he also derives it from a version of evolutionary theory.
Yes, which is quite ridiculous. Yeah.
But he's got a following. He's not just
a
crazy guy in the wilderness.
That's right. And he waited till he had a solid tenure to make these kinds of statements.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that that comes out of the woods or comes out from under the rocks.
Take these people. So if you want to know what I learned, I was reminded. Maybe I didn't learn it, but I was reminded anew. Take these voices seriously.
Absolutely. Back to the denouement of the actual trial. He is, of course, ultimately convicted. How does he take the sentence when he is sentenced to death?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The law in Israel is that judges do not have to impose the sentence that is given in the law, but they can impose up to that sentence. So if it is, you know, 20 years, they can give 5, 10, or 20.
Yeah.
This law is one of the few laws in Israel, in fact, I think the only law in Israel, in which there was a death sentence. Otherwise, Israel does not have the death penalty. And in fact, Adolf Eichmann is the only person in the history of Israel who's ever been condemned. Well, these two people were condemned to death, but he was the only one on whom the sentence was carried out.
Who was the other?
The other is Demjanjuk, but that was
John Demjanjuk, yeah,
but that was overturned by the High Court.
Yeah.
Ben-Gurion was, in fact, opposed to the death penalty. So when the judges came in to read their sentence, and the trial ended in August, and the judgment was read in December, so it took them quite a while to formulate it. They said, we do not believe we are obligated to impose a death sentence. And for a moment, some of the reporters in the room, and maybe even Eichmann himself, thought that he had escaped the death sentence, and he was very anxious to escape the death sentence. He did not want to die. They said, we do not think we are obligated, and the courts have ruled that we are not obligated to impose it. We feel it is just to impose it. And they imposed it, and they told him right away that that would be the case. And then they walked through why they felt it was a just sentence. He appealed to the Israeli High Court. The Israeli High Court heard the case and then rendered its judgment in May. And within a few days, the death penalty was carried out very quickly. Now, there was a great debate in Israel about whether it should be carried out. And there were many people, including some leading professors at the Hebrew University, Martin Buber, Gershon Sholom,
yes.
Hugo Bergman, the philosopher, and in fact, was one artist who was a witness at the trial, Yehuda Bakom, who was a witness at the trial, who felt it shouldn't be carried out. And at one point, Martin Buber, the famous Martin Buber, was part of a study group that met at the home of the Prime Minister, Ben-Gurion's home, a Bible study group. And Buber approached Ben-Gurion and said, they knew that the verdict from the High Court was about to come down. And he said, I'd like to talk to you about the Eichmann trial and the carrying out of the death sentence. Can I come to your office to talk to you? And Ben-Gurion said to Martin Buber, I'm 78, you're 84, whatever the age. You're older than I am. I'll come to you. So Ben-Gurion went to Buber's home, and they sat together for an hour. Buber quoted Hasidic masters on taking a life and how it was wrong to take a life, etc. But Ben-Gurion was unpersuaded, and the death sentence was carried out. Now, Israel had to figure out a way to hang him because they had no mechanism for that. His body was cremated. The Israelis did not want his burial place to become a holy site for neo-Nazis. And his ashes were scattered in the Mediterranean Sea.
His sons still have brought some sort of action against the Israeli government.
Yes, well, they wanted to get access to a memoir he wrote in his prison cell during the trial. And Hausner said to Ben-Gurion, and Ben-Gurion agreed with him after the trial, Hausner said, look, the man was on the stand for hours, for long sessions, for days at a time. He had a chance to say whatever he wanted to say. We shouldn't have any obligation to publish his lies so that they go out there again. And Ben-Gurion agreed, and it was left in the Israeli archive. At one point, the children of Eichmann tried to get access to it, and Israel was deciding what to do. A group of historians were appointed. Some people argued release it. Other people argued don't release it without annotating it, get it annotated, so saying this is a lie and showing the documents, etc. And in the spirit of the Middle East, nothing happened, and it sat in the archives. Yeah. And that was until my trial, and I asked for it to be released so we could use it as evidence, and it was.
Your trial in London.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we are about to pause for the usual reasons. Well, at the half hour for an update on the news. But before we do that, an invitation to all who want to join in the conversation, whether to raise a question or offer a thought or, for that matter, a memory. 312-591-7200 is the phone number, 312 591-7200. And for those who are up very early in the Middle East and listening to us over the Internet, or for our friends on the Pacific Rim who are listening to us in midday tomorrow, the access, of course, is via email, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Or for phones again, 312-591-7200 to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Deborah Lipstadt, author of the new book, The Eichmann Trial. That is, by the way, just published by Next Book, Schocken, and that in turn is an imprimatur and the division of Random House. 312-591-7200, our number at the moment. All the lines are taken. If you're trying to reach us, you're hitting a busy signal, but don't be totally discouraged. Just call again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller, and we'll go quickly to the first caller. Jeff has reached us. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Dr. Lipstadt, I believe there was a book written called Refuge in Hell. In the book, the author argues that Eichmann controlled the Jewish hospital within the very heart of Berlin, and it was staffed by Jewish doctors, and there were Jewish patients, and some 800 or so people survived as a result of that hospital. And I'm just wondering why Eichmann would have done something like that. What was the motivation behind it?
I know the book. I read it a while ago. And, you know, I'm not sure what exactly his motivation. I'm sure that eventually he would have ensured that they would be killed. He didn't keep them around to survive the war. There were pockets of Jews who survived in different places. But had the war gone better for the Nazis, they would have killed them all. Look at his record, which we mentioned earlier and didn't get a chance to really discuss, in Hungary. The Jews in Hungary are killed. The Jews who are killed in Hungary, and it's about between 400 and 500,000, are killed in the space of 7 weeks. Between beginning of May and beginning of July 1944. The Soviets are already headed towards Hungary. They're not far from Hungary. The Allies have landed on Normandy, you know, June. It's clear that Germany is going to lose the war. It's clear that it's going to be over. And yet Eichmann is pushing to kill as many Jews as he can. And then they leave, and he comes back in October. When a pro-Nazi group takes over in Hungary, and he's going to finish the job. He can't finish the job, but he wants to finish the job. So his intent was to kill every Jew he could.
I totally agree with you, and that's what makes this hospital such an enigma.
It is. There are many enigmas. It is an enigma, but my guess is that had the war gone a different way, those 800 people would have eventually ended up on trains to death camps.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Quickly to another on 312-591-7200, and Lee has joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hello. I had two questions. One was that old movie, House on Garibaldi Street, was that very accurate or not?
It's about the taking of Otto Eichmann.
Right. Yeah. It's based on a book by Issa Harel, the book House on Garibaldi Street. There's a lot of factual stuff in it, but there's a lot of, certainly in the film and in the book, there's a lot of things that we now know are not that factual. One of the things we now know is that rather than this being a near-perfect police action by the Israelis of swiping Eichmann out from under the noses of the Argentinians. Apparently, the Argentinian police knew the Israelis were there, knew that Eichmann had been taken, and probably knew he was on the plane being smuggled out.
Even though they protested, of course, for the violation of Argentinian law and sovereignty, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And protested very strongly in the United Nations. There, in fact, their ambassador to the United Nations was very simpatico towards the fascists, so he took this very seriously.
Well, this was in the time
Perón.
Of Perón, who himself was a fascist,
and,
and very sympathetic to all the refugee Nazis who showed up in this country.
Well, you know, it wasn't so much that they were happy to have Nazis, but they were happy to have Germans because Germans were whites.
Yeah, and they were happy to get their money as well.
That's right.
We thank the caller, and we move quickly to another 312-591-7200, and Maury is up next. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I just want to share, I'm driving now and I'm listening to it, and it jarred a lot of memories about my dad, who had passed away about 6 years ago. And basically what I want to tell you is that he was a Jewish man in the Polish army in 1939, and in the first 2 weeks of the war he was captured. And they were marching him back to Germany, and then somehow or other the German soldiers found out that he was Jewish, and you couldn't believe these were plain German soldiers, not the SS, but he experienced such anti-Semitism, and he knew he would have been killed as soon as they got where they were going, and he escaped one night and he went back to his hometown. But I just want to tell you, these were plain soldiers that were just so anti-Semitic. It was unbelievable.
Well, Maury, I think that's your name. You're making a very important point. For many years, the general impression was that the killings and the horrors, whether it was against the Jews or against others, but particularly against the Jews, were carried out by the SS and by, you know, committed Nazis, and the army, the Wehrmacht, the German army, was separate and apart, and it fought the clean war. We now know that in many places, the Wehrmacht soldiers took a direct role in the murders in the Eastern Front and the mass killings, whether they took it as part of their units or they had free time and they went and participated. In certain cases, Wehrmacht high-ranking Wehrmacht officers asked the SS quickly come in and get rid of these Jews. So the army's hands were not as clean as it would have liked us to think
in the initial time. That's my point.
And at the killer level, we know, particularly from Christopher Browning's book, which you mentioned earlier, Ordinary Men, we know that these were Ordnungspolizei. They were MPs, essentially.
Right.
But they carried a good part of the assignment of going into towns and killing off all the Jews they could find. And they did it after a while with some gusto.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Can I make one more point?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
When he escaped, he went back to his town. It was a little shtetl by name of Radun, R-A-D-U-N. And it was well known because there was the Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva over there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But what happened was that when the Germans attacked, they were attacking Russia and they captured this town, they never, ever took these people to concentration camp. They set up four machine guns in the square, and everyone died.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone. Mm-hmm. You know,
any American Jew who has parents or grandparents who came from there will also have stories about what happened to his or her relatives who never left the old country.
Right.
I have such stories. I'm sure, Deborah, you do too.
Mm-hmm.
312-591-7200 is the number. Let me read you an email I've got here. Wasn't there something recently about the film reels of the trial not being preserved, or they're being stored in the bathroom at Hebrew University? Something about missing reels and complaints about editing of the film reels. Do we have the whole film record
of
the trial?
No, we don't. In certain cases, I hate to say this, but it pains me as a historian and just someone who's interested in, anybody interested in history, because the film was so expensive, they taped over. After it was shown, they would just send it back and tape over some of that film. So we don't have all the records. In the initial period after the trial, some of the reels were stored. I don't think they were stored in the bathroom, but they were stored not in the best conditions, but that's no longer the case.
Here's a very interesting email I've got from an old friend. Edward is a professor of history and political science at a college near New York City. And he says, given her history with David Irving, your guest may be interested to know that the British government has just published its proposed reforms of the libel laws, which I gather will go a long way towards making it harder to use libel to shut down public discussion. The impetus for the change was a lawsuit a couple of years ago by the Chiropractors Association against a science writer who wrote that their profession is a scam. Did you know about this?
I knew it was in the works. I didn't know it had happened. And I thank Edward for letting me know. It's a little late for me. I had to raise about $1.5 million, $2 million in order for a defense fund in order to fight this case. But it does, it's important because it shuts down criticism in a very, very profound way.
Do you remember how I first met you?
On my first book on Holocaust denial,
no,
right?
But before that.
Tell me.
After that. I met you, sure, when you came to the studio on that book. So I'm wrong. My memory's a little bit wrong. But after that, one day I had a missive from somebody called David Irving, whom
I
had never met before, and about whom I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. But I had said one line of criticism about David Irving on some other program, and one of his faithful followers had undoubtedly written to him about it, and Irving denounced me for doing so and told me that it's a good thing that I didn't say this in England because then I would get the same treatment that he's about to administer to Deborah Lipstadt.
That's right.
And I didn't know what that was all about, and I called you that day.
That's right. And you said, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I remember that very clearly.
And the trial was coming up. I had not yet heard
about it. No, he uses this. He's not alone, but he uses this as a way of shutting down criticism.
Yeah. We're about to pause. Last round of commercials, then directly back. There are now some lines available, of course. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try. 312-591-7200. And by the way, just as they used to say about Levy's Rye Bread, you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's Rye Bread. You don't have to be Jewish to give us a call tonight. 312-591-7200. We return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Deborah, before we go back to the phones, a matter of my own curiosity. A curiosity about the state of Holocaust studies these days and the consensus, if any, has yet been reached on the crucial question of why and how it happened as it did. Does the division between the so-called intentionalist and functionalist schools still persist, or has that been resolved?
That's really been pretty much resolved. It's nowhere near, there were intentionalists and there were functionalists, but it really was an amalgam of the two, and that's sort of no longer the central issue. But
intentionalism was the notion that this was always Hitler's intention and the high Nazis' intention,
exactly.
And they just acted out on their plans.
Right, and the functionalist is that the desire for this came up from below, where officers in the field said, we started killing them, we have to do this more comprehensively, and pushed their superiors to come to it. And what we really now know is, as I said earlier, it's an amalgam of the two, this is something that Hitler certainly wanted done, and maybe those in the field began to figure out exactly how to do it, but it wasn't one or the other.
When I mentioned Milton Himmelfarb's classic article, No Hitler, No Holocaust, earlier, you remembered his first name, mm-hmm. which I didn't. Do you do you agree with the judgment given in that very title?
Yes, I tend to. While I'm not one who believes in or studies counterfactual, does counterfactual history, what if kind of questions, I do think that without Hitler, let me put it this way, I'll be a little more modest in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Without Hitler, it would have been very, very, or someone as with as burning a passion, a desire to destroy the Jews, it would have been very hard for this to happen. But it also would have been hard for it to happen without thousands of years of anti-Semitism. It would have been hard to happen without a church that was willing to stand by. It would have been hard to happen without a European society in which virtually no one, of course there were some exceptions, but of major institutions in Germany, no one spoke out against this, even when it was possible early on to speak out against not the killing but the persecution.
Yeah. Not even Pastor Niemöller until the very end.
Yeah, and when Pastor Niemöller was supporting the Nazi Party, he only stopped being a supporter of the Nazi Party, when he felt it was getting too extreme. He's given credit because he coined a very nice statement which calls for being vigilant, but he hardly is a paragon of virtue.
We go back to the phones on 312-591. 7200. Lynn is next on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I would like to ask a question. We are now helping to overthrow the dictators in the Mideast. What happened during the Holocaust, what took the world so long to rescue 6 million Jews?
Oh, if we had 2 hours, we couldn't even really finish to discuss that question. I think the world should have reacted, and should have is a hard statement, but could have reacted certainly in the 1930s and sent a message to the Germans that their persecution would not be accepted, that they would be a pariah nation. But the world didn't act that way. In fact, not only did the world not act that way, but there's a book that was recently published, I'm blocking on the name, by a guy named Norwood, on the Holocaust, on the American, the way the Nazi Party, not the Holocaust, the way the Nazi Party was revered on many, and Nazi Germany was revered on many American campuses through to the late 30s. So
how political actually was it?
I'm not sure what you mean, how political.
In terms of, I think it was FDR, they were afraid to losing the anti-Semitic votes?
No, that wasn't that at all. For FDR, once the war begins, for FDR, it's a matter of winning the war. One of the things we sometimes forget is that up until midway through 1943, it wasn't at all clear that the Allies were going to win the war. So I think that's something we really have to take into consideration. I think there's more that FDR and more that the Americans could have done. But at that point, their main focus, and one can't question it really, was to win the war. Their feeling was the way we're going to save the Jews is by winning the war.
Well, that was after we got involved in the war. I remember mm-hmm. we lost all the islands in the Pacific at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But why didn't we react sooner?
You know,
in 1939, I was there during Kristallnacht. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Yeah, of course.
So why didn't...
You mean you were living in Germany as a child?
Vienna.
Mm-hmm. In Vienna. Uh-huh.
Where it was particularly horrible. At Kristallnacht, the United States does respond. FDR makes a very strong statement. He allows any refugee, any person who's in this country, not as a refugee, but any person who's in this country who will suffer persecution if they go back to remain in the country. And he orders that the quota places be completely filled. The problem is, prior to that, American consular officials, many of whom were anti-Semites, I'm not saying that FDR necessarily was, but in the State Department, people have been diplomats for quite a while, made it very hard for refugees, particularly Jewish refugees, to come to this country. But of course,
that is
before the killing. So, I mean, it's not like they were saying, stay here and be killed. No one knew that was coming, but still they were being persecuted quite terribly.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call. I've got a caller waiting, but we don't really have time for it. My apologies to all those who are still waiting. But one caller wants to put the question. She says, I don't understand why Christians were so cruel to the Jews at that time, which is really a variant on the basic question of what is the source of anti-Semitism, which is the oldest established and long-lasting hate.
Milton, I think we'd need 2 hours to
We
really
would, of course. But all the same,
when a
kid raises that question in one of your classes, what's your short version?
My short version is it's a hatred that goes back. It's a hatred that the story of the killing of Jesus, the deicide story in the New Testament, has been used, interpreted, misinterpreted by generations of church leaders, not all of them, some of them, as a way of pointing blame at the Jews, making the Jews others. The Jews were a convenient scapegoat. It was Jewish obstinacy. They were obstinate. They refused to convert to Christianity. So it has a religious basis. But then, of course, in the 19th century, it morphs into a non-religious basis, looking at Karl Marx and others. So it's a hatred that has been fed year after century after century. I want to add one more point, since we come up and you had said in a jocular fashion, you don't have to be Jewish to call. I also want to point out that you don't have to be Jewish, certainly not have to be Jewish, to care about the Eichmann trial, because this is a trial that sets the pattern for trials about genocide from there on in. That at Nuremberg there were virtually no survivors who spoke, and after the or it was documents. After the Eichmann trial, there was hardly a war crimes trial that you did not hear in the first person singular from the victim.
I was very touched by your mention towards the end of the book of some Rwandan young people who are in Jerusalem or in Israel, trying to learn more about how to handle in the court and how to process the post, the aftermath of a genocide,
right,
which was worked in Rwanda, of course.
Right. If we have a minute, I can read it very quickly.
Yes, do.
Okay. This is the very end of the book. A number of years ago, I was invited to a conference at Yad Vashem. While there, I met a group of young Rwandans who had asked Yad Vashem to train them in how to conduct oral testimonies with trauma victims. They wanted to ensure that the history of the genocide that had decimated their country and their families would be preserved. Yad Vashem, eager to make them feel comfortable, arranged for them to have dinner on their first night in Jerusalem with French-speaking Holocaust survivors. By the end of the dinner, the two groups of survivors had bonded so strongly that the elderly survivors took the young Rwandans under their wings, invited them to their homes, introduced them to their families, and began to build personal relations. One afternoon, I sat with some of the Rwandans outside of Yad Vashem, looking over the Judean hills. They told me of their experiences during the genocide and their meeting with the Holocaust survivors. One young man, whose entire family had been murdered, said to me, "I want to tell my story and help my fellow Rwanda survivors tell theirs, just like the Holocaust survivors. I want people to listen to me as they listen to them." Mm. Despite the inherent contradiction in his next statement, I completely understood what he meant and recognized the passion with which he said it. I had heard it many times before from Holocaust survivors. Future generations, those who were not there must remember, and we who were there must tell them. This may be the most enduring legacy of what occurred in Jerusalem in 1961.
Yes. It's an excellent close to a very significant book. And the title of that book, from which we've drawn, but of course we haven't by any means plumbed its full detail and its depth, is The Eichmann Trial by Deborah Lipstadt, just published by Next Book Schocken. Deborah, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Milt. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Hope to see you in Chicago.
I do,
sometime
too.
Soon.
Take care.
Thank you. And we will be back again tomorrow night with another one of my favorite guests, Mark Stein, who is, I think, one of the best commentators on the madness of modern times, and a man of considerable political depth and insight, and also great lyrical wit in the face of what is sometimes near tragedy. At any rate, a very interesting guy that I'm sure you'll enjoy if you've never heard him before. That's tomorrow at 10. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.